Okay, this is one of two sermons I want to give on the book of Daniel. And we'll get into that. I just need to get my head into what we're doing here. The book of Daniel is, as we've always said, is history written in advance. And it's interesting when you look at other commentaries in various Bibles, that they have a commentary in them, they get this part right almost all the time, the early parts. I want to start covering the book of Daniel. We will do it today, and then hopefully, God willing, we'll do it next week. Not that we're anxious, but we're going to probably go into official granddaughter watch at the end of next week. She's due on the 4th, but it's hard to believe she could. I don't know if Curtis made her swallow a basketball or something, but that kid's getting big. So, and the baby's turned, and you know, everything's ready for the next step. So I think we'll be here next week. If we can, we'll finish it up. But if not, I'll still work on it this weekend. We'll still have it ready. So anyway, we're going to talk about prophecy written in advance. And a lot of this I got from the new booklet, of course, called The Final Superpower, that the church has put out. It's only available now if you run it off on your computer. I have run it off here. But when they first announced it, there was a booklet, but of course it's so much cheaper to do it this way, so they don't have to do that. When you look at prophecy, there seems to be a cycle that God puts in it. And I've talked about this before, so I'm going to briefly just repeat it. And that is, when God is, for example, going to punish Israel, He'll remind them. He'll take them through, I brought you out of Egypt. I cleaned you up. You were married to me. You violated the covenant. You've done this. You've done that wrong. You've done this wrong. If you don't repent, then you're going to be taken into captivity. And then that repeats, that cycle. Well, the prophets come and warn them. They don't listen. The only one that I can think of off the top of my head is Nineveh. And they weren't Israelites. But anyway. But then God always, after he says he's going to punish them, he promises his people, in this case, physical Israel, that you will not remain in captivity. I will bring you out. You're going to go back to the promised land. You're going to be the people I wanted you to be, which would be to be an example and a light to the whole world. But what we want to do today is sort of break this down, and that's why I just can't do it in one sermon. Break it down and see what the scripture says. Remembering, while we do this, though, we see through a glass dimly. I don't feel bad saying that since Paul said it. And he said he had been shown things by God that were he wasn't permitted to write down. You remember he said that. There was a man once, he thought he went to heaven. Maybe he didn't go to heaven, but it seemed so real to him. And he felt that that's one reason why God, well, I know it's, he said, because of the multitude of revelations that he had, whatever illness he had, God did not heal him of it because he says, my grace is sufficient to you. But he knew so much. And yet he still said, we look through the glass dimly. So what we see is an overview. And we cannot plug in names, you know, and dates and all that kind of stuff. Although it'd be fun to try. If you've been in a church a long time, you've seen that effort work. I mean, you've seen that effort attempted and failed in catastrophic manner. So, you know, you can't plug in names into prophecy in that type of thing. Anyway, the point is there's a plan and we're going to see how God's working with it. And sort of a subtext to our sermon today is think about, this is where I'm going to finish it and then we'll pick it up next time, but I want to introduce the thought that God had lessons and pretty much the same lessons that he wanted Nebuchadnezzar to know, a Babylonian king, a pagan as long as, you know, all his life. But he also wanted his servant Daniel to know, but from a different perspective. And so kind of keep that in mind as we go through here. As we know today, as it stands now, the United States is pretty much the only real superpower. Russia's building again. But right now we remain that. If you ever want to, there's a book, I haven't read it all yet. What would the world be like without the United States, without America? And it's quite interesting. Because everybody likes to beat up the United States for real or imagined faults. Every nation has them. But anyway, right now, we are considered the only real superpower. Russia's coming along. China's coming along very, very fast. And I'll get into some of that here. However, China is, they're having an economic collapse as we speak. They've lost over 30% of their value in the stock market. But when you look at the stock market, it went up like 180% for a couple of months in a row. That's ridiculous. Whenever you see that kind of thing, you ought to just, you know, go short and get out of there because it cannot maintain that kind of stuff. Well, what that means is they got factories that have been running for a long time and producing things, but nobody buying them, so they store it. And they kept making things, hopefully to, I mean, even under a communist-managed government, centrally managed government, they have trying to buy up these useless stocks to try to prevent a collapse, but it doesn't appear that's going to work. Europe, as we'll see, and what we've always believed would eventually rise, and we'll talk about that, it would supplant, as far as the major power, the United States, and then the only real enemy would be Russia and China for them. But anyway, so just a quick overview of that. So we have a new superpower coming, and a lot of the quotes I have here are coming from that little booklet. Can you see it? It's the final superpower. Instead of me typing it in, I thought I'd get really cool and put the booklet up there. So anyway, this not all the stuff is from that, but we'll start from here. There's only one true superpower in today's world, the United States. At present, no other nation can globally project power. By that, China's really coming along fast, but with their economy collapsing, we'll have to wait and see. There's still something we can guess, but we look through a glass dimly. As you'll see, Europe has the potential of becoming very powerful once they figure out some things that they're now figuring out. I can't get into all that right now. At present, no other nation can globally project power. If you have aircraft carriers, that's a wonderful way to project power. You see a carrier with a battle group come roaring in your backyard and you've been a bad boy, that kind of slows them down. So you can project power that way. And yet there are many challenges to America's maintaining this lofty and important status. Will another power or another superpower emerge from the nations and replace the current world order? World order got small. Sorry about that. And the answer to that is yes. And so today we're going to read about the world and how the Bible in today's world. It says the Bible does have something to say about today's world scene and what the future holds. Revelation and Daniel. We'll look at Daniel mostly today and then get into Revelation as well later on. Reveal the future. We'll seek a new kind of power. Let me read that again. I'm sorry. Revelation and Daniel reveal the future. We'll see a new kind of power to emerge among the nations that will astound everyone. And this is a quote from our booklet here that you see in the corner here. It will have, for a time, the ability to solve, it'll appear to be solving, some big problems that threaten order and stability. And we, again, this is the introductory. We'll have more next time. This is Daniel. He's an interesting individual. If you look at it in Scripture, you know, Jonah had a bad attitude. Oh, just a second. Speaking of bad attitudes, Jim Parkhill. No. I forgot to send this presentation. I wonder if Mrs. Gaiman, if you could send to Opal, to Sharla, you know, all the usual suspects. Could you send your link to all those people? Because I forgot to do it this morning. Anyway, so Daniel, and Mrs. Aguilar, too. I hope you got her email address. Daniel's an interesting man. When you see him in Scripture, you don't really see that he's rebellious in any way. He loved God. He served God. He was blessed for serving. But when, Nebuchadnezzar and later on other kings and like would talk to him, he said, if you don't want to hear the truth, don't ask me. Because he says, I am bound to tell you the truth. And when you're talking to a guy who thinks he's God in the flesh, he believes him, unbeatable and indestructible. It took some faith and courage to tell him that. Say, because he understood visions and the like, we know Nebuchadnezzar had visions and wasn't going to give that to. And he'd say, now if you don't want to know, don't ask. So he was a man who seemed to be absolutely committed to God. His ministry spanned the first two parts of the image that we'll talk about. Remember, Nebuchadnezzar saw the head of gold and the shoulders of silver. And he talked to the two leaders of that power that he saw. He lived in captivity. He never did go back to Jerusalem, which was one of the things he really wanted to do. Because he was faithful and God did show him the truth about these things and he took them to the king, he was well placed and lived, you would think, a pretty good life overall, but you weren't free. You were subject. You look at Jeremiah, he had a hard road out because his own people were the enemy. All right, so let's move on here. Again, we're going to ask, what lessons did Daniel learn? And the same lessons that Nebuchadnezzar learned. And believe it or not, it's the same lessons we learn. And it's the same lessons that when Christ comes back, the whole world is going to learn. That's why it's been preserved for us. All right. So you have Justinian. You have the various revivals of the empire. I'm just going to go quickly through this. Charlemagne came along. You have the various revivals of an empire. We'll get into more details as we go through. The ancient Roman Empire, but it actually started way back, as far back as Babylon. And you see just some of these leaders here who, some you don't know, some you know quite well. Charles V, these guys were key in helping to develop this system that we're going to be talking about. Again, I don't have time to go into Napoleon. Now, that's everyone, everybody knows. He failed to learn, I'm sorry, this fella failed to learn from this fella. You don't, this would be the revival of the Roman Empire. And again, I'm just showing you some things real quick. The last revival of the Roman Empire was through the Nazis. It is interesting now. I can't remember what, I think it was from the church, but I can't remember now. Everything he wanted, he thought he could take by power, overrunning and destroying Europe and making it his own image. Germany now has. The economic, and quickly now becoming the military powerhouse of Europe. That's what he wanted there. And everybody, what is Greece doing now? They say they're going to the EU to try to pull themselves out of their financial mess. But really what they're doing is going to Germany. Because Germany's the only one that has that. The problems that we're facing here, these different revivals, is they all had things in common. Even that salute there is one that they had in ancient Rome. Very cultic in that way. So let's move on so we get to some scriptures here. Since the collapse of the Soviet Union, Russia has had to redefine itself among the nations. It no longer has the size of reach of the USSR, where it had all of Eastern Europe and so forth. It was huge, and they are basically landlocked with one base. And that was good. You put the bear up there and landlock him. Yeah. The Israelites always seem to have access to the seas. But it does have vast supplies of oil and natural gas, along with a large military and nuclear arsenal. Russia is still a factor in world affairs, and Putin really wants to move Russia into its old glory. And so there he is, and he's an ex, I'm not sure he could ever be ex KGB man. Those were the secret police. And, you know, now they tell us he's a very nice. What did Mr. Bush say? He said, I looked in his eyes and I knew I could trust him. I'm thinking, you need some new glasses. You know, KGB, that you don't change the nature there. And he's becoming the strong man, really trying to redefine Europe and to form it, form his nation and get some of its power back. But they collapse financially. The United States is on the verge of a collapse probably this year. For the financial collapse that makes the 2008 one look like a picnic. So I can read to you lots of sources, and they're just saying it's coming and it can't be stopped. We're so far in debt, and there's no way to do this. When you buy your own debt to try to keep things going, that should be tell you what's going on there. Well, that was one reason why the Soviet Union collapsed, is at that time we wanted to enter other factors, but they just financially could not keep up with the arms race. And I think it was Reagan wanted to put those land-based missiles, they're portable. What do they call that? Anyway, in Europe, he put these missiles in Europe. They just couldn't keep up with it, and finally they collapsed. All right, let's move on here. This is quite interesting from the Stratfor written January of last year. A recent bulletin discussed the potential for Europe to rise to the level of superpower. It said, quote, taken as a single geographic entity, Europe has the largest economy in the world. See, now it's really sick. Prophecies say that Europe will, as we'll see here, they're going to have to go through a cleansing, and then when they come out, we'll probably see them become extremely financially powerful, while the United States will continue to decline. Should it choose to do so, it could become a military rival to the United States. It just takes the right leadership, the right set of circumstances to do that. Again, I'm not trying to get into politics. It's just an observation I'm making. The world is falling apart. And there is so much instability now that one thing could lead to another, that could lead to another. And so things are really unstable. Europe is one of the pillars of the global system, and what happens in Europe is going to define how the world works. But at first, Europe's going to have to go through this cleansing economically. They have to address the problem with Islam. The skyline, I believe, is France, right? There's more mosques than there are churches, if you'd stand and look out there. Whole areas of France and now England, the police don't even go in. They're under Sharia law. And they let it happen. But something somewhere we don't know, because again, we see dimly. We see through a glass dimly. We watch and see what's going to happen. So anyway, so they have that potential, but there needs to be a catalyst. And when Christ comes back, this system will be functioning wonderfully. It's going to be pouring the money. Everybody's going to be getting rich off them. And then Christ comes back and messes up the whole thing. So, and that's why they'll go to war and fight him. And they'll say, who can stand up, and I'm paraphrasing, against the beast, and so forth. All right. The Bible in today's world, everyone will be amazed and happy that it does, that Europe will be revived. And it will be. I don't know how. You know, who knew that Germany would be reunited? What is that, 1981? And so when that was happening on the news, I tried to use that as a learning moment for my kids, who were quite little at the time. I said, we knew Germany was going to get reunited. We didn't know it would be this way. We didn't know the mechanism. The problem is, East Germany is so used to the socialist way of doing things. East Germany is a poorhouse and does not have a good work ethic. And so West Germany is trying to change that. Because remember now, for two generations, they were totally cut off from the West. So anyway, but in time, a benevolent mask will be removed to reveal power with a heart bent on bringing people under its control. This, in the end, will not be well received, but the trap will be shut and it will be too late to back out. That's what's going to happen in Europe and all around the world. Possibly the financial collapse that might happen this year, maybe that will trigger when everything falls apart, new ideas will come forth, and at first it's going to look good, and things are going to start getting better. You don't appreciate them getting better unless things get really bad. And that's what they will do. Daniel, among the Jewish captives taken from Judah and exiled in Babylon, was a young man, and he had some others with him, whose Hebrew name is Daniel. He was renamed to Belshazzar. They gave them Babylonian names. Let's go to Daniel 1, and I'm going to be reading from the New Living Translation. Daniel 1. Probably wondering, we're not going to get into that scripture. And I hope you'll study this on your own, because I can't possibly get it all. Well, the church has put out some excellent material. This is good. There's another booklet we'll look at, the Book of Revelation Unveiled at Last. That's another good one. And so here we're going to, and also keep in mind that both Nebuchadnezzar and Daniel needed to learn these lessons, but for different reasons. Daniel 1, verse 1. During the third year of King Jehoiakim's reign in Judah, King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon came to Jerusalem and besieged it with his armies. The Lord, again, this is from New Living. The Lord gave him victory over the King Jehoiakim of Judah. When Nebuchadnezzar returned to Babylon, he took with him some of the sacred objects out of the temple. Because, see, he believed in all kinds of gods. And so when you overrun a people, you go to their temples, take some of their goodies out of the temple, and you take it back with you. Because you want to keep all these gods happy, so when you capture their people, you grab stuff that used to worship, and then they would do that. And so this is why this was done. When Nebuchadnezzar returned to Babylon, now it's interesting, the Egyptians at this time, this is not in the scripture, but in your study of history, the Egyptians at this time defeated Nebuchadnezzar's army in Egypt. And that's why Nebuchadnezzar had to turn around and get out of there, leave Israel and get back home so that he could try to protect his empire from there. But when he left, he took some of these people with him that they're talking about here. And then later, Jehoiakim of Israel thought, well, look, the Egyptians beat Nebuchadnezzar already. Why should we be a vassal state to Nebuchadnezzar? And Jeremiah said, don't listen to that. God is going to put us into captivity. And then we're talking here about Jeremiah. And they said he was unpatriotic and so forth and thought he was a nut. And what he wanted to do is he says, if you want to live, you have to hear what the Lord is saying. He's saying, surrender now. Don't fight him. Because, and then you'll live in captivity, but they wouldn't listen. But they were so full of sin. As we'll see next time, in Jeremiah says, my people love to do evil, and it's all they think about. Something like you'd see in the Tower of Babel when that was, or the flood. Anyway, he took, this is the middle of 7, Nebuchadnezzar. When Nebuchadnezzar returned to Babylon, he took with him some of the sacred objects from the temple of God and placed them in the treasure house of his gods in the land of Babylon. Then the king ordered Ashpenas, who was in charge of the palace officials, to bring to the palace some of the young men of Judah, royal family, and other noble families who had been brought from Babylon as captive. That's a smart thing to do. You take the top educated people, the people in the higher classes of the nations you defeat, then you bring them back to your headquarters, you are watching them, you re-educate them in the image you want them to be politically, religiously, and then you also can tap their brilliance and their various skills. That's, in a way, it's from a human perspective, not a bad idea. And so that's what they did. Make sure that they are, we're in less, verse 4, select only strong, healthy, and good-looking young men. Ha! I wouldn't have qualified. He said, make sure they are well-versed in every branch of learning and gifted with knowledge and good sense, as that says in the modern translation, and have the poise needed to serve in the royal house. They had to know how diplomatic protocols and how that was all done. Teach these young men the language and literature of the Babylonians. This is part of now shaping them into what they want them to be. And it they didn't just do it with these guys, with Daniel, Meshach, and Abednego, and so forth. Any nation they conquered, they did this. The king assigned them a daily ration of feast food and wine from his own kitchens. They were to be trained for a three-year period, and then some of them would be made his advisors in the royal court. So, Daniel, and the other names here that he gives them, and then they also get their Babylonian names. You see that right down here. Meshach, Shadrach, Belshazzar, and Abednego. Verse 8, but God made up his mind not to defile, but Daniel made up his mind not to defile himself by eating the food and wine given to them by the king. It is a little supposition here, but could this be because it was unclean? They had a real, real special, from what I've been able to see. It would be like you know how they make hot dogs? They take whatever's left, eyes, nose, ears. Hope you enjoy your hot dogs. And they grind it all up and stick it in this skin. The Germans are really good at that. And that's why they call them krauts. Never mind. So, where was I going with this? Oh, and one thing that they would do here in Babylon is they would take some of the body parts of their enemies, grind them up, make it kind of a sausage meat out of it. And the idea is you could get their spirit, but you're also showing them contempt by doing this. And that could have been part of the issue too. You know, I don't like the pig, and I sure don't like eating my neighbor. So whatever it was one of these or both of these things together. Now, but Daniel, verse 8, made up his mind not to defile himself by eating the food and wine given to them by the king. He asked that the chief official be for permission to eat other things instead. God had given the chief official great respect for Daniel. So he stood out. Daniel stood out. But he was alarmed by Daniel's suggestion, because if things didn't go well, not only would those guys be killed, but he would be killed, because he failed in his duty to prepare them for their new job. My lord the king has ordered that you eat his food and wine. And he said, if you become pale and then compared to the other youths your age, I'm afraid the king will have me beheaded for neglecting my duties. Daniel talked it over with the attendant who had been appointed the chief official to look after Daniel, Hananiah, Meshach, and so forth. Verse 12, test us for 10 days on a diet of vegetables and water. Okay, just because he's trying to make a distinction. And, of course, it went very well. I can't read all of this. Verse 17, God gave these four young men unusual aptitude in learning the literature, science, and science of the time. And God gave Daniel special ability to understanding the meanings of visions and dreams. When the three-year period of training was over, so they had that 10-day initially, and it proved that they would still be healthy, they went through another 3 years of intensive training. While the king had been completed, the chief official brought all the young men to King Nebuchadnezzar. The king talked with each of them, and none of them impressed him as much as Daniel and his three buddies there. So they were appointed to his regular staff of advisors. Well, that's good and bad, because as we'll see, when the king had these visions, he did something unusual. He told the seers, and in this case, that's what they would call Daniel and his friends, the other Israelite people. They were also included in this group, but Daniel didn't know about the dream. And Nebuchadnezzar wouldn't tell his advisors what the dream was. He says, you tell me what it was and then interpret it. They said, well, it can't be done. So God is setting up even your own, and they said, if you can't show me within 24 hours, it's, you know, off with your head. Not fun to work for this guy. Where are we at? The last part of verse 19. So they were appointed in his regular staff of advisors in all matters requiring wisdom and balanced judgments. That's why I like this modern. In balanced judgments. The king found the advice of these young men to be 10 times better than the musicians, enchanters, and entire kingdom. Daniel remained there until the first year of King Cyrus. We'll get that. So, anyway. So, you see now some things have been set up. He and these other people are in captivity, but they are living a comfortable life. They're with the king, but you have to be careful. And again, there's Daniel for us. More about Daniel. He served the high officials both in Babylonian government as well as successor in the Medo-Persian Empire. So the image that Nebuchadnezzar had, Daniel addressed those two leaders during his lifetime. But the other kingdoms would come away after he would be dead and way before us, except for one. All right. This is from the same book. God has revealed that last and evil superpower of men will only last a short period of time. Jesus Christ will return. So just before Jesus returns, this system will revive. How long will it take to revive? If you've been in the church for a long time, you've heard this kind of sermon over and over and over. The difference is, I think we're trying to be balanced. We can't say, okay, in 5 years it's going to be that. Because God said, Jesus said, don't try to figure all that out. You have a gospel to preach, go preach the gospel. Because the way these prophecies are set up, they're going to happen. Because God knows human nature. Now, could a nation repent? Yeah, like Nineveh did. And he said, the judgment won't come on this generation because you guys have repented. But it will hit the next one. Because the next one wouldn't be repent. These things are going to happen. And this new religious super, final super power. And then Jesus will come back and destroy it. So this superpower is brought on the scene just before the second coming. Remember Christ? I mean, in Matthew says that Satan knows his time is short and he goes out with great wrath. The purpose of prophecy is to give us glimpses of the future and a hope for God's promises, and so that we may draw close to Him. So, you know, when you study these prophecies, you know, you might say, I'm not quite sure. That's why I kind of like reading some of the new translations. Sometimes they're good and sometimes they're terrible. But it may help you to see some of these things. Right? So it's coming. And again, from this book, by inspiration from God, Daniel explained the details of the dream to Nebuchadnezzar without having heard what the dream was about. That's pretty cool. Did you see that? Okay, so we see this huge image. You have the image that Nebuchadnezzar saw, and that is the head of gold. And he says, you, and I will read this in a minute. He says, you are that head of gold. Silver chest and arms of the Medo-Persian Empire, which Cyrus would be the leader there. And this prophet, by now, when he said Persia, that he was getting to be an old man. He'd been around a long time. And he kept taking care of it. Then we had the bronze and belly and thighs. These represent the Greco-Macedonian Empire. I don't know if you can read all that or not there, but I read it. And then you had the iron legs, and we'll talk more about that in a minute. The two legs of iron represented the Roman Empire after Alexander the Great's death. Again, so much. Ptolemy and all these other people. And they got in a fight with each other and so forth and so on. We can't get into all that here. The iron and clay feet and toes really represents that final revival of the Roman Empire. The last one that revived was Nazism in Europe. And we got a taste of what that would be like. But in this case, the new leader probably won't be like this horrible Hitler and his Zika. He will, I'm trying to think off the top of my head. He will be a smooth talker, that's how we'll put it. We got experience with that now, ourselves. Living with it. And when he says, I'm here to help you, we're all here to help you. We've gone through this terrible economic problem, religious problems, the world's a mess. And he will be able to do, when you talk about the false prophet, he'll be able to, this is Daniel, perform lying miracles. They will be real miracles, supernaturally done, but from the wrong spirit. Instead of the Spirit of God, it would be, and those things grab people and pull them in. Remember, it says even there would be such power in this that if it were possible, even the elect could be fooled. It's going to be very difficult. Let's go now to Daniel 2 and verse 1. One night during the second year of his reign, Nebuchadnezzar had a dream that disturbed him so much he couldn't sleep. He called his magicians, enchanters, sorcerers, and astrologers, and he demanded that they tell him what he had a dream. As they stood before the king, he said, I had a dream that troubled me. Tell me what I dreamed. And then he said, here, for I must know what it means. And the astrologers answered the king in Aramaic. That's maybe that language. Long live the king. You start out, yeah, you're the man, okay? But I have something to tell you. Tell us the dream, and we'll tell you what it means. Well, he knew these guys are charlatans. And he said, no, I'm not telling you anything. You guys claim to have all this ability. And behind the scenes, what is God doing? Is he not setting up Daniel to bring him before Nebuchadnezzar? Because these guys, they say, you're asking impossible. This has never been done. Only God can tell your dream if you don't tell us. Well, guess what? That's exactly what happened. But verse 4, then the astrologers answered the king, long live the king, tell us the dream, and we will tell you what it means. And the king said to the astrologers, I am serious about this. If you don't tell me what my dream was and what it means, you will be torn limb from limb. Maybe it was Al-Qaeda, I don't know. And your houses will be demolished to heaps of rubble. He was serious, wasn't he? But if you tell me what I dreamed and what the dream means, I will give you many wonderful gifts and honors. Just tell me the dream and what it means. And he said, please, your majesty, tell us the dream and we'll tell you what it means. You can make any dream mean whatever you want. So if you had a dream last night, I can divine your dream. And how do you know? It's just nonsense. And he knew it. But God is preparing him. He says, Nebuchadnezzar, you know, he was really a proud and arrogant man. The king replied, I can see through your tricks. As it says in the New Living, you are trying to stall for time because you know I'm serious about what I said. If you don't tell me the dream, you will be condemned. This guy, life didn't mean much to him. You know, and that's why tyrants are. You have conspired to tell the lies in hopes for that something will change. But tell me the dream and then I will know. You can tell me what it means. And the astrologers replied to the king, there isn't a man alive who can tell your majesty his dream. And for time's sake, one of the handlers for Daniel that was supposed to work with Daniel and the others, he came and said, man, you guys are in bad shape. Because tomorrow morning, if the king doesn't get the answer, you're all dead. Daniel goes, what? So again, he said, can you arrange for me to see the king? He said, yeah. So he just said, just give me tonight and God will show me what it is. And you know the story, that's what happened. Verse 17. Then Daniel went home and told, as he already encountered the king, and told his three helpers here, I'm going to butcher their names, what happened. He urged them to ask God, the God of heaven, to show them his mercy and tell them the secret so they would not be executed along with the other wise men of Babylon. That night, the secret was revealed to Daniel in a vision, and Daniel praised God in heaven, saying, then he praised God. Now, I know I'm reading a lot, But we're just not going to rush through this. We want to take our time. This is what he's praising God. Praise the name of God forever and forever, for he alone has all wisdom and power. He determines the course of world events. He knows the course, even directs it. We've talked about this, the British expeditionary. What am I trying to say? Forces during the first part of World War II, they got stuck in Dunkirk. And weird fog came in and just set up. And the German general, he was ready to go and just kill them all, the thousands and tens of thousands of men who eventually made it back to England by, if it could float, the British said, get out there, we gotta get these people back. Because they would lose the war because it would just be too many men killed. And the general, I forget his name, German general, he told Hitler, we can finish this now, but God determines history. Now, people think they do, but God determines history. And the general was told, no, the men need to rest, Hitler said. You know, here's another tyrant of that time, the last Roman Empire, you know, up to this one that's coming. And he says, all the troops are tired and they need rest. And so they got rest, and the general was furious. Thank God he didn't listen to his generals, because he knew he was smarter than all of them put together. And he was nothing. Okay. So, as far as that goes. Now, verse 22, he reveals deep and mysterious things and knows what lies hidden in darkness, although he himself was surrounded by light. You see the demonic forces and how they're working and so forth. I thank and praise you, God, for my ancestors, for you have given me wisdom and strength. You have told me what we asked of and revealed to us the king's demand. Now, we've talked about this before. This is the dream that you have in front of you here. This, of the various empires, the various kinds of metals would show that the character, sort of a reflection. You know, gold had more character, but gold is not very, you can't use it as a weapon. It's, you know, it's too soft. But you come down to silver, which is stronger than gold, which means they're more powerful militarily, and yet morally and the like, they're more degenerate. And it goes down that bronze is the same thing. It's not as strong as silver and not as valuable as silver and so forth. And then you finally get down to iron mixed with clay, which is just people, various nations coming together. And if you know anything about European history, that ain't happening in this lifetime. The British don't trust the Germans. The Germans hate the French. The French hate everybody. Not really. The French don't trust the Germans. The Germans don't trust the French. Anyway, so it's a mess. But something's going to coalesce this for a short time. Verse 24, then Daniel went to see Arioch, that's the handler, who had been ordered to execute the wise men of Babylon. Daniel said to him, excuse me, don't kill the wise men. I'm saving all of them. It's interesting because later those same people did everything they could to destroy Daniel because he was enjoying a lot of blessings from Nebuchadnezzar for answering this, giving an answer for the dream. Don't kill the wise men. Take me to the king, and I'll tell him the meaning of the dream. So he quickly brought him to Daniel. Daniel to the king. I have found verse 25. Arioch was telling the king, "I have found one of the captives from Judah, who will tell your majesty the meaning of the dreams." The king said to Daniel, also known as Belshazzar, but that's his Greek name. Is this true? Can you tell me what my dream was and what it means? Daniel replied, There are no wise men, enchanters, musicians, fortune tellers who can tell the king things, but there is a God in heaven who reveals secrets and has shown King Nebuchadnezzar what will happen in the future. He's not, will it, maybe it might happen, but it will happen in the future. Nebuchadnezzar, what will happen, shows Nebuchadnezzar what will happen in the future. Now I tell you your dream and the visions you saw laying on your bed. While your majesty was sleeping, you dreamed about coming events. Or, you know, how would life transpire after, because of his greatness? And he kind of wanted to sleep like that. The revealer of mysteries has shown you what is going to happen. Not what might happen, but what is going to happen. And it is not because I am wiser than the king, than any living person. I know the secret, of your dream, but because God wanted you to understand what you're thinking about. So Nebuchadnezzar's by a slave and a servant, yes, in Nebuchadnezzar's house, saying, I don't have any smarts of my own. God has shown me what this means, but he wants you to learn that lesson too. And we'll see what that lesson was. It's the same one we learn now in our lives and the same one the world will ultimately learn. We'll see what that is. Your Majesty, verse 31, in your vision you saw in front of you a huge and powerful statue of a man shining brilliantly, frightening and awesome. The head of the statue was made of fine gold. Its chest and arms were silver, its belly and thigh were bronze, its legs were iron, and its feet were a combination of iron and clay. Now all of that is history up to this last part, the feet of iron and clay. But as you watched, a rock was cut from the mountain by supernatural means. It struck the feet, It struck the feet of iron and clay, smashing them to bits. The whole statue collapsed into a heap of iron, clay, bronze, silver, and gold. The whole geopolitical system of the world goes back to the Tower of Babylon. And it's waxed and waned. You know, you can read about Nimrod, we will later on, and so forth and so on. And he's saying, in the end, it's all just going to end up to be a heap. But what will happen then? The pieces were crushed as small as as chaff on a threshing floor. I mean, just grind this whole system up and destroy it. The wind blew them all around without a trace. But the rock which knocked the statue down became a great mountain that covered the whole earth. That was the dream. Now I will tell your majesty what it means. Your majesty, you are the king over many kings. Some would say king of kings. Which Jesus would ultimately have that title, wouldn't he? The God of heaven has given you sovereignty, power, strength, and honor. Who? The God of heaven has given you this. And you are his instrument to punish Israel for its on and on and on sinning and refusing to repent. But he's telling them, you're the one. My God, even though I'm your slave, my God has given you all of this. That was verse 30. Because God wanted you to understand what you were thinking about. He's thinking about this, how the future is going to transpire with him. And how powerful he was. Your majesty, in your vision, you saw in front of you a huge and powerful statue of a man, shining brilliantly, frightening and awesome. The head of the statue was made of fine gold and chest. Okay, we read that. Now, I have a hard time reading this eye. Verse 36, and I tell you the dream, your majesty, and what it means. Your majesty, you are the king over kings. The God of heaven has given you sovereignty, power, and honor. If you were a slave, and you're looking at the man who led the country that put you into slavery, and now you have to tell him, my God gave you that. Yeah, and imagine he's, Nebuchadnezzar's just going to say, yeah, that's what they all say. You know, live long and prosper and all that. Maybe they do the Vulcan sign too, I don't know. Verse 38, he made you ruler of all the inhabitants of the world, the whole known world, he ruled over it, and has put even the animals and birds under your control. You are the head of gold. But after you a kingdom comes, and Daniel would see this come to pass, another great nation inferior to yours will rise. This is the different metals. They're inferior to each other. This show you how that works. The different metals in this statue. After your kingdom comes to an end, there another great kingdom, inferior to yours, but still going to be great and powerful, will arise to take your place. After that kingdom has fallen, Yet a third kingdom, represented by the bronze, belly, and thighs, will arise to rule the world. These are all ruling empires, and you're the first of it. You're the head of gold, and then he goes on. All of these will be ruling empires, at least in desiring it. Following that kingdom, there will be a fourth great kingdom as strong as iron, and it would have eventually 10 revivals. That kingdom will smash and crush all previous empires. It would take those areas, because the various empires would cover a certain different land masses. It would this would just come in and just assume it all. Verse 41, and the feet and toes you saw were a combination of iron and clay, show that his kingdom will be divided. Some parts of it will be strong as iron, and others will be weak as clay. This mixture of iron and clay also shows that these kingdoms will try to strengthen themselves as forming alliances with each other. That's very well put, see, through intermarriage and so forth. You know, because that's the old way during the Middle Ages. If you were the king's daughter, forget about you picking who you're going to marry. They were usually politically aligned. Maybe they had a big war with another empire, another group. And they, okay, well, let's settle this. You got a son, I got a daughter. Let's marry them off. Therefore, we're sort of connected to one another. We'll kind of help each other. That's a very quick way of looking at it. But anyway. But this will not succeed, the last part of verse 43. Just as iron and clay do not mix, during the reign of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that will never be destroyed. So that, the ten toes, which is the revivals of, and like of the Roman Empire, they come and they go, but that last one will be destroyed himself by Christ. And that's what this image is showing in the vision. That's what he saw. He said, what does that mean? And he knocks down the whole statue and it would just be ground to dust. But there's now this new kingdom. And so, as it says here, verse 44, in the reigns of those king, God, the God of heaven, will set up a kingdom that will never be destroyed. No one will ever conquer it. And it will shatter all these kingdoms into nothingness, but it will stand forever. So that's Jesus comes and establishes his kingdom on the earth. So you see this here, that it comes and hits it. There is a mistake here. I don't want to point it out, but really what I show you here is this slide, that this whole system is going to collapse. It's going to set up a kingdom. Now Daniel, we just read this, says here, the Babylonian Empire was represented by the head of gold, the silver, bronze, and iron components of the image or statue represented three powerful empires who would follow after Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar's dream occurred and was interpreted by Daniel around 600 B.C. And this is one of the most panoramic prophecies that he was shown. Now, Bible scholars being Bible scholars say Daniel was written after Daniel dead and gone. And they just, people would take events and write them and then project them back. But even outside sources, most of them say the scholarship or the debate on that is very shallow and can't really be supported. This was a miracle that was taking place. The image represented, okay, we were talking about it. Well, let me go back here. It says the image represents in symbolic form the sequence of great empires that would dominate the religious political scene for centuries. And that's what we're waiting to see. Right now, the Catholic Church is barely existing. It's an absolute turmoil. And this new pope has turned out to be a pretty interesting guy. I know some of you probably have. How many of you saw on YouTube the pope coming over Skype or whatever it was, and he spoke to some of these well-known Protestant evangelists, and he says, we're all brothers. We all believe the same thing. You believe it in your church, we'll believe it in ours. How many of you have seen that? Okay, and I'll see if I can get a copy of it to show you. It was quite disturbing when you know what's happening here. And they all said, we're all Christians because we've accepted Christ. We just worship him in a little different way. Where does that leave us? Judaizers. Crazy. Let's go to Genesis 10:32. You see here, I'm just, for time's sake, I'll just refer to it. Genesis 10:32, Nimrod came along and says he was a mighty hunter before God. Oh, okay, I'll turn there. If you look at the Hebrew, it means a whole lot more than it does in the English for Nimrod 10:32. Just a second. Chapter 10, verse 32. These are the family. Okay. These are the descendants of Shem, identified according to their tribes, nation, territories, and nations. These are the families that came from Noah's sons, listed nation by nation according to their lines of descent. The earth was populated with people in these nations. And then we go here to chapter 11, the Tower of Babel. It talks about, we'll get into more of this next time. It says Nimrod was a mighty hunter before the Lord. The word before is a very poor translation. It actually means against. Verse 8. Where are we going here? Oh, I'm in 11. No wonder it didn't make sense. Verse 8. Is it 10:8? Is that what you're saying? One of Cush's descendants, Cush is one of Noah's sons, was Nimrod, who became a heroic warrior. He was a mighty hunter in the Lord's sight. And it's really incorrect. It really should read, in place of. He wanted the people to look to him to protect them. And so they stayed in, and all that. Okay, God is the author of families and tribes, as it says in this article. God's historic desire is for nation states to live according to his law. And yet they wouldn't do that. In many ways, the Bible is a historical record of a series of superpowers that have come and gone. Many were strong in their day, but left no lasting legacy or mark on the world. Others, however, changed the whole course of history for millennia to follow. The Greeks certainly did. The Romans certainly did. The book of Daniel contains a prophecy of both historic and future importance. And again, it's another translation here in this little round circle thing. In the annals of history stand a silent testimony to the success or failure of nation states. And really, they've all failed. Again, Daniel again. Well, here's one picture. I wasn't there, so I wasn't able to get Nebuchadnezzar's picture on my cell phone. So I found this. So we're trying to figure out how he looked. And he would have this dream. And here's, little old Daniel up against this God figure. They considered him a God. They both learned some very important lessons as we go through here. And let's take a look at what those lessons are. Daniel 3, verse 8 through 14. This is what Nebuchadnezzar had to learn. So we'll go back now to Daniel. In Daniel 3. Now I am just flying by a lot of stuff, and you probably know that if you studied it, but this is really the whole thing of this sermon I hope we will walk away from. Daniel 3, verse 8. But some of the astrologers went to the king and informed on the Jews. They said, "The king Nebuchadnezzar, long live the king, you issued a decree requiring the people to bow down and worship the golden statue when they heard the sound of musical instruments." So everybody was to do that. This was set up by the people that Daniel had saved earlier. Remember? Daniel saved. But he was... This is a political struggle in which Daniel didn't want anything to do with it, but he's caught in the middle. That decree states that those who refuse to obey must be thrown in the blazing furnace. Now this is, they wanted his office, they wanted his blessings and his things that, that Nebuchadnezzar had given him. And they set this law up, and you have the laws of the Medes and the Persians and so forth. And in this time when, especially later on they'd have that, Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego, whom you have put in charge of the province of Babylon. These are powerful, politically placed people. They have defied your majesty by refusing to serve your God or to worship the golden statue you have set up. Then Nebuchadnezzar flew into a rage and ordered these three guys, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, to be brought before him. And they were brought before him. Here's what they said. Nebuchadnezzar said to them, "Is it true that you refuse to serve my gods and to worship the golden statue, which would be of him?" Remember, he's the head of gold, so now you've got a whole statue of him in gold. "The vanity of the man I have set up, I wish you one more chance. I'm going to give you one more chance. If you bow down and worship the statue I have made, when you hear the sound, when you hear the sound of music, so I'm going to give you one last chance." Then verse 16, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied, and it was Daniel who would be speaking for them. "O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God of heaven whom we serve is able to save us. He will rescue us from your power, your majesty." You know, he's going to do that. "But even if he doesn't, your majesty can be sure that we will never serve your gods or worship the golden statue you set up." And it infuriated him. He said, "Stoke up the furnace." And it got so hot that the soldiers that were throwing them into the furnace, they died. They were burned up. And then they look inside and see, he said, "We put three in there and I see four." And they realize, they walked out of that fire. Nothing was scorched. Nothing was burned. Now let's, for time's sake, you know, I hope you write those verses down and check them out. Daniel 4:4. "I, Nebuchadnezzar, was living in my palace in comfort and prosperity. But one night I had a dream that greatly frightened me." These three guys were in the furnace of fire, came out, and Nebuchadnezzar is just blown away. He said, "Boy, no one could have done that except your God is the God of gods." He still believed in multiple gods, but boy, this God of Daniel, boy, he's got some good credentials because he keeps defeating Nebuchadnezzar and trying to control things. So now he's seeing this vision again. This guy had a lot of visions because God is working with him. And I think this was all preserved for us to learn these very same things. God is in charge and he is working geopolitical things out. He's working things out in our lives, like we heard in the opening prayer. You know, whatever your journey is to prepare you to be part of the ruling family of God. And, now let's just back up here. Okay, well, time is just getting away. Let's go to chapter 4, verse 1 now. "King Nebuchadnezzar sent a message to the people that every race and nation and language throughout the world says, 'Peace and prosperity to you.' I want all of you to know the miraculous signs and wonders of the Most High God has performed for me. How great are his signs, how powerful his wonders, his kingdom will last forever and rule all nations." This was his conclusion after he went crazy and so forth and so on and so forth. Now let's move here to chapter 4. For time's sake, we'll just stop right there and I'll pick this up about here with the next sermon. So what was it that he wanted to teach Nebuchadnezzar? And you know, he went mad for 7 years. after saying, all my hand has done this. And within a year, he was out in the wilderness like an animal and eating like an animal. Is insane. He said, God says, you know, this is how the world is. This is how people are. They're wild animals. They're vicious to each other and so forth. Let him, so he went out there. And finally, after 7 years, he comes out and he says here, verse 34 of the same chapter. He's come out of his insanity. He goes home. 34. Verse 34. At the end of the days, Nebuchadnezzar lifted up my eyes to heaven. Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes up to heaven, and my understanding returned to me, just as God had said it would be after 7 years. The nations are crazy too. I've got my finger there so I won't lose it. I was watching a program, and I believe it's in England. Either that or France, I don't recall. But if you come from another nation, and you come and you start working in the EU, you know, in one of those countries, then what happens is, of course, you get paid for your work, which is fine. Then they say, well, where are you from? How many relatives do you have? And relatives for one or two generations will also receive money from Europe because one of your people are here working for us. Well, now the accountants are figuring this out. It doesn't work. And that's one reason why they're going broke. It's not the only reason. So, you know, I need to get a relative to move over there and they will send me some money just because he showed up there. And, you know, there have always been people in Europe who say, this is not a good plan, this thing, this Euro thing. And some of them knew that. But anyway, so you can see why they're broke. At the end of the day, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted up my eyes, verse 34, unto heaven, and my understanding returned to me, and I blessed the Most High, and I praised and honored him that lived forever, whose dominion is everlasting, a lasting dominion, and his kingdom is from generation to generation. That's the one thing Nebuchadnezzar had to learn. I don't think God was calling him, but this is the same lesson that God wants every nation to know, and they will. Eventually they're going to know it. Because when Christ comes back, the lightning from east to west in the sky, they'll see him coming in the clouds of heaven. He's going to have to defeat the armies of this revived Roman Empire that we just talked about. And their pride and their arrogance. Well, he had to learn not to do that. And Daniel had already learned that lesson, but he's reminded, you walked with humility before God. You have the gift of understanding dreams and visions, he knew. And he knew that would come from God. So he said, both of them learning, don't walk in pride. And I don't think Daniel had that problem. We know Nebuchadnezzar had it. But Daniel seemed to always understand that, but God was reiterating and teaching him that. Also, here's Nebuchadnezzar, who is viewed as a god himself, but he says Daniel's God is the Most High God. He's higher than any other god, and you guys better remember that. That's what Daniel knew that. But when the kingdom of God comes, they're going to learn the same lesson, the very same lessons. God's kingdom is eternal. You even said that. God rules in the affairs of man. Scriptures tell us that. He rules in the affairs of man. You don't see it, but he intervenes in history over and over and over, which keeps things moving in a direction that we've been seeing. Now this is Cyrus. He represents the chest. He would come along next. It would even be more destructive with military power, but they would be less moral, more degenerate, becoming more and more like animals. And really, the prophecy of the experience that Daniel had was that this is not Daniel. Nebuchadnezzar had that this is the way the world is going to live. It's crazy. He says 7 years. You can say, but eventually that would end and the kingdom of God would be established. And again, the world today, these prophecies, there's many, many of them. Let me just talk briefly here before I stop. I try to find sources that talk about the economy, and try to find, I think, good sources. And here's just a few things. What's his name? Oh well. He has an update and he calls The End Is Near. Now he's a financial guy, he's not religious. He says the great crash is imminent, six signs to look for just ahead. And this was written July 16th, so it's pretty new. The Greek default proves that all this endless quantitative easing idiocy couldn't live up to its promises. It can't keep buying debt. It puts off the inevitable. It has proved unable to create sustainable long-term recoveries in high indebted developed countries with poor demographic trends. One of his major themes is that you can predict financially how things are going to go overview because of demographics. Now, at the end of World War II, for example, millions of men got out of the service, the war was over, and they created my generation. You know, get out of the Army, Navy, Marine Corps, come home, start your life, and so hence my generation was born. And the economy kept growing because they had all these young families, they had all this need for things. They did a GI Bill to help guys get better jobs. All these different things. And so, just from a demographic point of view, you can see why the United States has just had unbelievable wealth and been very, very blessed. But now, most of the American, let me correct myself, most Caucasian Americans are pretty much what we have in here. No offense, but we're getting older. And if you're younger, you're truly a minority. If you don't believe that, you can go to the mall and take a walk and ask yourself, how many old white guys are there in here? No, there aren't any old ladies because they don't get old. And look around. In Israel, the various Israelite nations around the world are dying out. They've not replenished themselves. I did my bit, three kids. I got my 2.4. I don't know how to do that. Okay, they're having grandchildren. But we've just kind of wondered, you look on our street where we live, just a regular neighborhood, there's either very young families or older people. And so that's, and the church is a microcosm of that. And we're aging rapidly, aren't we? And we're not replacing ourselves with young people. So anyway, he says a few things to look forward to that show that everything's about to go downhill. Number one, China stock market and real estate bubble has collapsed. They've lost a third of their value in a month, and they're now in a free fall. So China will have to reorganize itself. It will come into play in prophecy, but not in the way most people think. That's for next time. Next up for China stock would be around 2,000 or 2,500. That would level. Ultimately, it should fall to 1,000, which would mean an 81% drop. And so, and number two, and he wrote this here, U.S. stock market bubble, the U.S. stocks could be the last major market to make a new high of 2,145 to 2,165, and I will get all these numbers. That will be the best place to exit if you're going to, you know, if you're interested in all that. At this point, it's likely to see a break through the bottom end of the stock market. I'm trying to generalize this. It will be the greatest downfall, down to about 1,980. In the end, he's saying this, the stock market is very close to collapsing here. He says oil prices will drop. Which they have. They've done some recovery, but they'll drop to probably $32 a barrel. And why was that done? And again, just trying to show you, God's working here, but there are situations that human beings are doing, and they think they're so smart, and they're getting this all done, and God is behind the scenes. He says, this is going to happen, that's not going to happen. This is going to happen, going to do this. I've got to punish my people because they rebelled against me. But I got to set this thing up. So he's moving around. He chooses who leads the nations. And up until a few months ago, the United States was the largest oil producer in the world, even more than Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia knew that. And so what he did, all they had to do is dump a lot of oil in the market, which would drop the price. And so now fracking oil, that's what made us crush it, make it come out of rocks. It's an expensive endeavor. That's almost stopped. And that's why, like, Odessa's suffering right now and so forth. But this was known by the cartel. Let's just dump all the oil we had. So supply and demand. So oil prices came down. And now it's not feasible economically to do fracking as it was a few years ago. So he's thinking you'd probably get $32 a barrel of oil. Remember when it was $150 a barrel? Anyway, next one, commodity prices in emerging markets. They didn't make new highs in 2008 crash and have been in a four-year trading range from $36 to $46. I don't get it off. Next one, Treasury and sovereign bonds continue to rise in rates. So he's saying here that he really does believe that we may get another stock market crash. Probably, I hope not while we're at the feast, but it'll be right around that area, somewhere around the feast time. And that's not unusual. They've had four or five market crashes right around that time. Anyway, another fellow here, a young man from, where he's from. He lives in South Florida. And he says, you know, his generation is not interested in buying homes anymore. It doesn't seem to be feasible. And he also sees the end of the financial world as we've known it. Now, we all want Christ to come back. We all say, it's kind of like dying. You don't mind dying. It's just getting there. It's the hard part. I didn't update you on my mom. She was in a lot of pain this week, and so they took her, hospice took her to a hospital. How much fluid did they take out? 4.5 liters of fluid around her abdomen, which caused a lot less pain for her. So she's continuing to fail, but she's got all kinds of family around her. Sorry to update you on that. So anyway, the economy is very, very shaky, and I've seen more sources in a long time that are saying it's probably going to be this year, and it's going to be bad. In 2008, the economy should have collapsed, and it would have been better. Because once you go through the pain, it's like going to surgery. You're hurting, you try the pills, you try this, try that, and you're hurting, you're miserable. But at least I don't have to go to surgery. And finally the doctor comes in and says, you've got to have surgery because you're not going to get any better. It's going to get worse for a little bit. You need the surgery. Well, that should have, financially, they needed to let these companies and other things that were really broke, let them collapse. I know it's horrible, but then you start over. And it's much like a Jubilee year. You know, all debts were forgiven. That way you don't have a debt-driven economy. God's pretty smart. Our economy is a debt-driven economy. I need a car. I'm going to go buy one. I'll buy it on time. I'm going to buy a house. Most of us don't have the means to just put cash down. So we buy it, get a mortgage on it, and the banks go, thank you very much. And so we are a debt-driven economy. And you can only do that so long. And now we're reaching the end of our rope. As they already are in Greece, and as Europe is crumbling under the weight. So the more you spend, all that doesn't matter. Okay. I know I've gone through a lot, but I had to skip a lot too. I'll be, God willing, doing this again next week, where we can talk in more detail, get into even more scripture. But keep in mind, as you look at what's going on in the world, these are the lessons, remember, that Nebuchadnezzar had to learn, and that Daniel was reminded of. We need to keep in mind, God directs the affairs of men. That's what it says. So we need to continue to ask God for a guidance in our lives, to watch over us, and to give us wisdom and good, sound judgment as we now enter into a new time in history, like we talked about last week. The world is changing radically in front of us. And it's all designed, ultimately, to bring this whole system to collapse. But also, again, remember, Satan is there, and he wants to get us discouraged as we see things going wrong in the world. Just keep in mind, God rules in the affairs of men. He taught Nebuchadnezzar that, reminded Daniel of that, and he's there to remind me now. And I hope we will spend more time in prayer and fasting to draw close to God, because a time of great deception is just about to come. I don't know if it's this year, next year, five. I don't know. I don't know those things. But I won't say I'd like to read the tea leaves. That's not right. But if you just have, when you get familiar with this material, that's why I suggest you go get the Final Superpower, the little booklet. You can order that and run it right off your computer and read it. It would help you. Revelation Unveiled at Last. Read that. It gives us an overview. So as we continue to live in a world that's getting crazier and crazier across the board, we know this is the birth pains. We got to go through it. We got to go through the birth pains. Father, give me the wisdom and the judgment that Daniel had to keep my head on my shoulders, to keep you first and foremost in my life so that I don't get tricked or betrayed or lied to and fall for that lie. That's kind of why I'm spending some time the last couple of weeks talking about this subject, because we need to be ready. We need to steady ourselves spiritually, because things are going to change in a big way. I don't know when. We don't want to be caught unawares. So draw close to God. Don't get crazy with, okay, there's prophecy. And boy, when that pickup truck hit that corner at 80 miles an hour, and if you divide that by 2, and then you can multiply by 4 and put it on the chart, you can figure out when Jesus comes back. I mean, people do that. And you just forget that. Look at the overview. Draw close to God. And when you look at the world around you, pray, Father, thank you that you're calling me out of all this. And help me not to be discouraged as I see what's going on in the world, but to be encouraged. We had to get here. As it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be when Christ comes back. In just the last month, we've seen that make huge movements in that direction. Keep your head on your shoulders, draw closer to God, and ask Him for wisdom so you will always see the truth and not be deceived.